Airbnb and Uber are the ultimate 21st century internet businesses, according to our guest author this hour. We will explore how these companies got their start, how they affect our lives, the economy, and culture, and what's next for them. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. So do you use Uber? Maybe you're an Uber driver or maybe even a competitor. How have these services changed your life? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let's welcome our guest. Brad Stone is with us. Brad is Senior Executive Editor of Global Technology at Bloomberg News. He is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon. He has covered Silicon Valley for more than 15 years. He lives in San Francisco. His latest book is The Upstarts, How Uber, Airbnb, and the Killer Companies of the New Silicon Valley Are Changing the World. Good morning, and thank you for getting up extra early for us.
Good morning, Joy. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the details of your book, I wanted you to react to what we're seeing in the news this morning. Uber CEO Travis Kalanick made headlines this week when a video surfaced of a heated argument between him and a Uber driver arguing over falling fares. Kalanick has issued an apology saying that he must fundamentally change as a leader and grow up. So what was your reaction first to the video and his response?
You know, that was that was a sort of personal story for me because I oversee tech coverage at Bloomberg, and we got that video from the driver. And so we had to work that, through our internal system and make sure we were comfortable with publishing it and really ask whether it was news or not. And where we landed was, this goes to the heart of the questions people have about Uber. It is, it's monstrously successful, but it's gotten where it has because of the personality of its CEO, because Travis is so pugnacious and can be so combative, and we saw that in the video. The driver is his customer in a way, and yet they get into this heated argument, and he kind of loses his temper. Very Travis-like. He wasn't really wrong on the substance of the argument they were having about why Uber has had to lower its fares, but the driver was telling him that this is making his life very hard, and Travis wasn't reacting with a lot of empathy. So I thought, it was extremely revealing in that it goes to kind of his personality. But he had to be hard charging because he built Uber, in a regulation encrusted business with a lot of competition. So, I think the apology was, they've had a really rough month with a lot of poor revelations, and they're in this mode now where they're going to find the nearest sword and impale themselves on it because this is not a good look for them.
Yeah, it has been a rough month with now this, also public outrage over his involvement with President Trump's Economic Advisory Council and the trending Twitter hashtag Delete Uber.
Right.
And then there was a blog post by a former employee detailing stories of sexual harassment at the company. So What in the world is going on with Uber? Is it going to be able to weather these scandals?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, the best thing they have going for them is that people do, some people love the service and have come to depend on it. They've created a strong alternative to the taxi industry, and when you provide something that people generally like to use, it's going to take a lot to unseat you. That said, this is all bad. I mean, they grew very quickly from 500 to 11,000 employees in a couple of years, clearly without the, muscular, human resources organization that you need in large companies. That has resulted in some chaos. The Delete Uber campaign around his involvement in, on Trump's business council, I think, Uber is a San Francisco company with San Francisco employees. We like to call it the People's Republic of San Francisco. So, maybe he misread a little bit of the political environment right now. Yeah, and in some ways, that Delete Uber campaign at the time seemed a little bit unfair. But look, I mean, Uber has enjoyed a lot of financial success very early on. And I think we expect, you know, a certain kind of humility from those kinds of companies and a certain kind of, like, civility. And Uber just hasn't showed it, you know, again and again. And so it might be held to a higher standard, but it certainly is kind of seems to have failed it recently. So they got to get their act together, you know, particularly because they're transportation in our major cities. And, you know, that's important to our society. And so I think they have to, you know, they have to be held to a higher standard and get a little bit more professional very quickly.
So was Kalanick's apology PR, or does he need to do some soul searching here and grow up?
I mean, look, it was definitely damage control. But the answer to the second question is yes. I mean, you know, I've covered, you know, business leaders for a long time, and, you know, you would never find Jeff Bezos of Amazon or Mark Zuckerberg, you know, Facebook, yelling at a customer. You know, they're far too smart and tactical for that. So, you know, I think the video is very damaging and revealing. And, like, you know, he shouldn't have done it. I think business leaders at that level have to be politicians and choose their words carefully, and sometimes too carefully. So, yeah, the apology might have been an abundance of PR, but the video of Travis arguing with the driver was like a total absence of it. And, you know, sometimes we do lament that our business leaders are too political, but this is what happens when they're not, you know, and that's damaging to the company.
Well, let's start from the beginning. How did Uber start?
Right. Well, you know, this is very fun for me as a technology reporter, is separating the mythology from the reality. You know, and I talked to all the early members of the company, and the founder wasn't Travis Kalanick, but one of his friends named Garrett Camp. And he was inspired by a scene in the James Bond movie, Casino Royale. I don't know if you remember that movie.
I do.
There's a product placement in there for a Sony phone that shows, this is back in 2006, shows a car moving on the phone. It's like, it's an ad in the movie, but it inspired Garrett Camp to say, hey, you know, when the iPhone came out in 2007, and then the Apple App Store in 2008, he started wondering, can you really do this? Can you, you know, watch a car that's coming to pick you up move on a map? And at the time, he, you know, the San Francisco taxi cab industry was really broken. It was poorly serving people. And he thought of it as an opportunity to like send a limo your way, or a black town car. And that was the start. And it's funny, they really underestimated the opportunity of the business. You know, they thought it was a high-end car service. And it wasn't until Lyft, you know, the competitor, came out with this idea of ride-sharing in 2012, the idea that you don't need a chauffeur's license to drive a car. Anybody can drive a cab and pick up a passenger in their own car. That's what we call ride-sharing. You know, and Uber saw that. Travis, who was then CEO, thought it was illegal. But when California didn't put Lyft out of business, he launched UberX. And that's really the beginning of what we now see as Uber, because that is the service. Anyone can drive their car, as long as it's not a junker, pick people up, use the app, get paid easily. That's the beginning of UberX spreading around the world, and this company raising a ton of money and being valued very highly.
How big is Uber today?
Yeah, a couple of different numbers. You know, it's got about 11,000 employees. It's in over 500 cities, including most of the large ones in Wisconsin. It is valued at an incredible nose-bleeding $69 billion, which, you know, may start to look a little high if they keep having these PR crises. You know, it's a private company. I don't have the revenue figures offhand. At Bloomberg, we've reported, I think maybe they're over $3 or $4 billion for 2016, but they're unprofitable. So they've been losing money, and that's partially because they're fueling this expansion into different parts of the world, like India and China, where they spent a lot of money last year and then ultimately withdrew because of local competition. And they're investing in things like driverless cars and food delivery. So it's by all measures, become very large very quickly, and yet they still have a lot to prove in terms of making the model work.
Interesting. I do remember when Uber first came to Madison, there was quite a fight over that because the taxi cab drivers in the traditional cab companies weren't very happy about that. And then there were concerns about, will these drivers be safe to use? And so there's quite a battle. Was that typical?
And very typical, and that is what kind of conjoins the two companies in my book, Uber and Airbnb. You know, these were companies that, unlike maybe some of the Silicon Valley startups of the past, you know, brought technology into the real world, were moving around real things, people or cars, or you know, making apartments or homes available, and we're getting into the realm of local regulation, transportation regulation, and zoning regulation of Airbnb. And so Uber had a fight in every city, in every state, in every country in the world, because I won't go too deep into it, but conventionally taxis were either, you know, yellow cabs and you could hail them, mm-hmm. or town cars and you could prearrange them with a phone call. And Uber kind of broke it. You know, it was a digital hail. You hailed them on your phone, and you didn't need a medallion. And so, and in places like New York City, medallions would sell for $1 million. So it kind of blew away all the old classifications, took advantage of some ambiguity in the regulations that were made 100 years ago, and had a fight. And you know why these companies succeeded ultimately is because you know they were aggressive and people did love them. And so I can't quite remember what the circumstances were of the fight in Madison, but I know in a lot of places, you know, Uber simply would send an email to its customers and say, hey, the city council is looking at us. If you like Uber, if you want it to stay, send them an email or, you know, send them a tweet. And people came out to these companies back then. And so, you know, that is, at least in North America, why they have managed to succeed. They're still Uber's still having problems in places like Europe and South America with regulations. But in most cities in the U.S., it's kind of passed through the gauntlet of the first set of fights.
Right. Well, we'll talk about some regulations and fights with Airbnb happening in Madison, and we will continue talking about how these upstarts got their start and where they are headed, talking about Uber and Airbnb. Welcoming your questions for our guest, Brad Stone, who is the author of The Upstarts. Do you use Airbnb or Uber? Do you compete with them? Do you provide the service? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Brad Stone. He is the author of the book, The Upstarts, How Uber, Airbnb, and the Killer Companies of the New Silicon Valley Are Changing the World. And we wonder if they are changing your world. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We have Mary Alice on Facebook who says, I use Lyft and I love it. I'm going to start using VRBO, Vacation Rental by Owner, and Airbnb to travel this fall. Brad, first off, does anybody use Lyft anymore? Is Lyft still around?
Yes. Not only our correspondent uses Lyft, but Lyft is a strong number two to Uber. And in fact, I think it was reported yesterday that they're looking at raising more money now. You know, it's funny. A lot of these Silicon Valley businesses tend to be natural monopolies. They have what we call a network effect, which is, you know, they simply have, you know, so many riders that the drivers come over, so many drivers that the riders come over. But it hasn't happened, maybe worryingly, for Uber. You know, Lyft is still around. They've got access to capital. Partly it's we're still in an environment where people want to invest in technology startups. But also Lyft has been able to create a distinct brand. I mean, if you notice, when Uber's had all these PR problems, Lyft has been pretty quiet. And they've managed, and maybe it's illusory, but they've managed to kind of carve out a reputation as the kinder, nicer, gentler ride-sharing company. And so I think they are here to stay. General Motors is a big investor in Lyft. you know, and we're going to a world where cars drive themselves, you know, maybe not anytime soon, but one day. And you know, I think a ride-sharing network like Lyft will be of interest to someone. Maybe it's GM, maybe it's Google or Tesla. So I do think Lyft is here to stay, and it is quite popular in some places.
So what's the difference between vacation rental by owner and Airbnb?
Yeah, good question. So VRBO is actually one of the very first, let's call it the kind of home sharing services. It started out as kind of almost a classified advertising listing. And, you know, Airbnb, much, you know, probably 10 years later, really more online and focused on people sharing homes within cities at first. And you know, we can get into the Airbnb story, but mm-hmm. it quickly became much larger. VRBO was acquired by another online company called HomeAway, and then HomeAway was acquired by, I think, Expedia. And so they've become similar, but I think you can think of VRBO as like that beach home, and Airbnb identified a much larger market in, like, around the world, major cities, any place, not just vacation destinations. And now they are really more competitors.
Well, you know, and it seems to me the last time I used VRBO, it wasn't all that convenient. It was kind of a hassle. I had to email the owner of the property and had to wait for a reply and this, that, and the other thing. It took a long time rather than just, you know, entering a credit card and making that reservation and be done with it. Isn't that one reason why Airbnb started?
No doubt. I mean, I think what Airbnb has been able to do successfully is remove all of the friction and the obstacles around doing something that, let's be frank, our mothers told us never to do, which is like walk into a stranger's home, right? Yeah. It's not a natural behavior. And two of the Airbnb founders are graduates of a design school, and they went and they created an experience that makes it possible to trust the stranger and to be comfortable with it and to see who the host is and to go and arrange the payment and the transfer of keys with a minimum of hassle. And, yeah, I think VRBO, you know, having been created in an earlier time and perhaps doesn't have the entrepreneurial energy of an Airbnb, or at least didn't have the same drive to go and simplify the experience. But, you know, Expedia, which owns it now, is a big internet company. You know, they're smart operators. And I think there's no more mystery around why Airbnb has been successful to focus on millennials, urban areas and stuff. And so I think with, you know, what you're seeing with some of these other competitors is that they are trying to catch up. But as you point out, maybe they still have some work to do.
I'm going to go to Todd in Green Bay. Hi, Todd.
Hi, good morning, Joy. Good morning to your guests. And a couple of questions. One is, do room taxes and associated things like that, other fees that hotels typically charge, do they apply to Airbnb and VRBO? And my second question is, when I was on Airbnb, I noticed a lot of places had private rooms for rent within a home, and other places were whole apartments or whole homes that you could rent. And wondering again if there's a difference in whether fees apply if you're renting just a private room or if you're renting a whole home or if they don't apply at all. So that's my question. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Todd.
Yeah, great questions. It's funny because my previous book, Joy, as you mentioned, was about Amazon. And Amazon, you know, moved into a lot of states without paying sales taxes, collecting sales taxes on purchases. And then eventually when states kind of woke up to the lost revenue opportunity, it struck deals and, you know, which required it to pay sales tax, but, you know, gave it a little bit of an extension. Airbnb took the same approach. It went into states like Wisconsin, did not collect the room and board taxes. Customers were supposed to pay it themselves, but of course nobody did. But what we've seen over the past couple of years, and it did happen in cities like Madison, is that Airbnb struck deals and they agreed to some things, like hosts would have to get permits and they would only be able to list their places for like 90 nights a year if they weren't going to be around. And then they did agree to collect taxes. So Airbnb does collect the hotel taxes. I'm fairly sure in most Wisconsin cities, some of the deals are still pending. But, you know, they've had to get, like all these Silicon Valley businesses, they kind of barged in, you know, didn't quite play by the rules. and then have come around and gotten certified afterwards, sort of the beg for forgiveness but don't ask for permission strategy. The second question is, you know, is basically an easy one to answer. Like, you can find everything on Airbnb. It's kind of one of the reasons why the company has succeeded, from you know, a couch and or a futon in someone's home that they might be listing, to the in-law apartment, to a beachfront property somewhere on the coast, to a castle in England. You know, that the Airbnb celebrates the variety. Now, you may not want to go and sleep on somebody's couch, and so they trumpet the fact that they're kind of personalized to you know, to what you're looking for. And certainly I wouldn't want to do that, but you know, I do like the idea of maybe going and taking over a home as a, you know, on a vacation as an alternative to, you know, a hotel, right? That's going to be appealing to some people, particularly if you have kids and you don't want to rent out that extra hotel room. So, yeah, there's a lot of selection and variety on Airbnb.
Yeah, recently the Madison City Council introduced a resolution to hire a company to track down providers of Airbnb services that are not complying with the, you know, with the regulations and with the collecting this room tax. So apparently there are a number of providers who are not officially registering and maybe not charging this tax or giving it to the city. Is that a common problem?
It, you know, it is. And I got to say, like, Airbnb, you know, it hasn't been like the most diligent policeman on its own marketplace to make sure that people are complying. And perhaps, you know, they might argue that they don't really have a responsibility to do it legally. But I think a lot of cities are a little disillusioned with the company. The fact that, you know, it's a very idealistic company about, you know, bringing people together and giving you an authentic travel experience, but at the same time, maybe allowing people to skirt the law. And, you know, cities are overwhelmed. Like, the, you know, the Madison Zoning Department does not have, you know, the people to go and make sure everybody is, like, obeying the law and not basically, you know, turning their homes into illegal hotels. Like, cities, you know, protect their residential neighborhoods. People, by and large, maybe feel a little uncomfortable with tourists coming in and out to their neighbor's home at all hours of the night. And look, it does have an impact. We don't exactly know how much on home prices and rental prices. You know, when you start taking homes off the market and instead turning them into tourist properties. So I do think, you know, that experience in Madison is a common one. You know, cities are now waking up to the impact that Airbnb is having and looking for ways not only to regulate it, to pass smart rules that limit the use, but then they go and enforce that in a big, messy online marketplace where some people may not be obeying the law and where the company really doesn't have an interest in cracking down because, of course, it wants to show its investors great growth numbers.
Interesting. I saw a TV report, too, recently where someone who provided Airbnb services, a room in his house or something, he was upset that he was complying with paying this sales tax or turning over this sales tax and others were not because it, you know, put him at a disadvantage. So I guess there was interest among people who are providing this service that everybody follow the rules.
I think so. Yeah. People want to see, they want to see a level playing field. You know, I think there's different kinds of Airbnb hosts. You know, there's the good, what I call in the book, the so-called good Airbnb, you know, where someone really is just trying to make ends meet, you know, and list an extra home or the in-law apartment. And then you have people that are just taking advantage of the system that go and stitch together a network of four or five apartments and homes that don't live there, you know, that have become sort of de facto hoteliers. You know, Airbnb says that is not what it's about. They don't want to facilitate that kind of behavior. But, you know, like we see in lots of online marketplaces like eBay or Craigslist, you know, there are people that will take advantage of them. You know, you get scammers on these networks, and it's kind of the company's responsibility to go and police that. And I think, you know, Airbnb has had to, you know, kind of embrace that responsibility when it might not be in their economic interest to do so because they're, you know, a fast-growing private company and they want to show their investors that, look, it's another, you know, quarter of 500% growth. So they've had to kind of mature into embracing the responsibility that comes with policing their site.
We're talking with Brad Stone. He is the author of The Upstarts, How Uber, Airbnb, and the killer companies of the new Silicon Valley are changing the world. And we wonder if you are a Uber or Airbnb user, how have these services changed your life? Do you drive for Uber or rent out your home using Airbnb or a similar service? Let us know how this is changing you, your life, your community. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Denny in Wapaka is with us. Hi, Denny.
Hi, good morning. Two quick stories. I'm a small businessman, 67 years old. I pay all my workman's comp, liability, health insurance, retirement for my staff, and I often compete with companies that pay none of those. But neither here nor there. I was in New Orleans a week ago, my wife on vacation. I've never used Uber because I don't use cabs much, but I do use cabs because they're investment. The cab driver told me their business was off 50% the last 5 years, largely because of Uber and maybe Lyft. And then yesterday I wanted to go to another city with three friends, guy friends, to do some pub research. Sounds like a good trip. But went to four hotels, big hotels in a major city. All of them were booked or couldn't give us what we wanted. Ended up, I've never used Airbnb before. It took me 10 minutes to get on it. Got a four-person loft apartment with a hot tub overlooking the city for half the price of any of the hotels. So those are my two comments. Have a great day.
Thank you for sharing those. Really powerful, too. So do you think cab services are down 50% in many cities?
No doubt. And it's funny how Danny just described that with some sympathy for the taxi drivers, which I share, and then not a lot of sympathy for the hotels, which aren't creating like great options and have higher prices. So let's look at them both. So, I do have sympathy for the small business owner who might have saved up for a medallion. But by and large, taxis, that medallion was, went up every year reliably. And you had large fleet owners that were basically, requiring their workers, their drivers to drive for 12 hours a day and pay, and there was an economic arrangement that wasn't that beneficial to drivers. And then, the stories of taxis not serving minority neighborhoods or outer neighborhoods are kind of famous. So, I think that the fact that their business went down was, a sign that, they haven't fared well under new competition. Now, you could also say that, they're hamstrung by regulations, whereas maybe Uber and Lyft were not as much. But, a lot of cities, the taxi industry hadn't changed. They hadn't added a lot of cars. All of our cities in North America are growing very rapidly, and so they hadn't really, they hadn't kept up with demand, and so I think they were ripe for disruption. Hotels, I think, Danny illustrated why Airbnb has been successful. It is both these companies are creating options that people like, and sometimes at lower prices. If you travel with kids, which it does not sound like in that instance what Danny was doing on his pub research, but if you travel with kids, hotels are expensive. You're going to get two rooms and pay like two full prices, and Airbnb has just created an option. So look, if people didn't, embrace these services, they wouldn't be successful. And I think both of the industries, have had to respond, to the competition and in some cases some innovation.
Danny did mention, though, that he, I think, checked into four different hotels that were either sold out or didn't have what he needed. So the people are still using hotels. But
yeah.
once word gets out that Airbnb will give you better stuff for less money, that it might change.
Well, it's a good point I don't know the national numbers, but hotels in New York City had their best year in 2015.
Yeah.
And Airbnb is taking off in New York, even though it's under some regulatory challenges there. And so, it's also the fact that as the economy is doing well and people travel, you can't just put up new hotels.
Right.
Right. And so, demand is, demand surging. Cities are growing. People want to travel more. People want to leave their cars at home and take cabs. And in these regulation industries, you couldn't just grow supply. And so both these companies have come in, and by allowing people to share their existing asset, they create a way to meet that demand. And that's pretty powerful.
So Marie in Dubuque, Iowa, called to say that she is in the bed and breakfast industry and found that she had to join Airbnb and Expedia, et cetera, in order to keep up with everything that's going on. So you can be a B&B, a regular B&B, and join Airbnb?
Yeah, mm-hmm. No, for sure. I mean, when you look at, like, the businesses of bed and breakfast, you know, these you know, it's the charming little Victorian home in a city, but how'd you find them before? You know, it was mm-hmm. it was maybe word of mouth or an online classified website. Maybe your travel agent knew about it. And so, you know, basically Airbnb has just given these little small businesses at HomeAway and VRBO, they've given these small businesses a way to market themselves. Now, you know, they might be charging a little bit of a higher fee, but, you know, most B&B owners I know now do some business on one of these online sites.
Yeah. Mark in Madison is with us. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What is your example?
Well, it seems to me that the paradigm needs to shift of how easily we approve hotels and taxi cabs and the like. And you were mentioning that earlier, of course, so I won't go into it in detail. But the regulatory process is too concerned with keeping upstarts and competition out and not enough with making sure that supply is met. A few moments ago, you said, well, we can't increase the supply enough to meet demand. Well, that's in the conventional system we've had, that's probably true. We need to find new ways of meeting needs, and we need to change the regulatory process to allow respectable is the wrong word, but regulated, appropriate, and permitted uses to come into play. The fact is, there is a way to meet the demand, and that is with Airbnb. It's just not a good way. It's disruptive, it's inconsistent, and it doesn't necessarily mesh with community plans. That said, those community plans have to yield to reality, and that's the problem. They're not. Medallions in New York City became so expensive that nobody could get into taxi cabs, and that's why we have Uber in part. Airbnb responds in communities like Chicago, where it's been very difficult to build new hotels. You know, the point, if you look at history, about 50 years ago, there was a huge shortage of hotels in Tokyo, and they decided to make it possible to build hotels where men slept in tubes. I don't think Americans are particularly interested in that, but, you know, it worked for them, and it met demand. We need to be more creative. That's my point. Thanks.
Air tubes. All right. Brad, what do you say?
That's a great call. You know, it's interesting the way in which the two industries, the taxi industry and the hotel industry, really shot themselves in the foot by resisting change and by you know, by resisting efforts to add supply, as Mark said. So, you know, there were efforts in most cities over the years to increase the number of medallions and get more cabs on the road. In San Francisco, we would see it almost every year, and the cabbies hated it. They would circle the Public Utilities Commission building and honk their horns in protest because they didn't want the extra competition. And I can't speak as confidently to hotels, but, you know, yeah, I think Mark's right. In a lot of cities, the regulatory process was burdensome, and you had neighborhoods probably coming out with NIMBY battle saying, you know, we don't want our cities to become purely hotels. And so as a result, like, these two industries were encrusted by regulation, and then these upstarts come on the scene and kind of grow unfettered. So, yeah, I mean, I think right now there's a sort of lopsided world where you've got these technology companies operating without a lot of limits, and the conventional industries still having to move very slowly. And so, yeah, a fairer playing field would say, okay, we're gonna start putting many more yellow cabs on the road, or we're gonna let different kinds of hotels, you know, sprout up. I'm familiar with the capsule hotels in Tokyo, and it would be interesting to see some of that creativity come to the U.S. But instead, we got, like, the low budget, you know, Motel 6 type hotel by the freeway. And I think in an Airbnb world, you know, where you can get a lower price home or room, that's the kind of hotel that's going to be endangered because, you know, not a lot of creativity there in that format, not a great experience for customers. So, I agree. It's like the shackles have to be taken off of some of the conventional industries that they hope to compete.
Lucy in Madison is with us. Hi, Lucy.
Hi. I've used Airbnb, and I think the concept is really great, but I was upset when they used to have a 24-hour hotline you could call in case you had a problem, and they just stopped having that. So now if you're someplace and you don't have a real smartphone or something, you can't reach somebody. And on top of that, I think that could be dangerous. And I went to Chicago one time just from Madison, and I had an Airbnb set up, and the woman who owned the place emailed me not too long before I left and said that she couldn't do it that night because she had some other appointment. And so then I was left in the lurch. I didn't have time to go get another Airbnb. I had to leave. I didn't have time to even make a reservation at a hotel. So I decided I would just drive home that night. So I drove home from Chicago to Madison late, which was kind of excruciating, as you know.
Yeah, that's a long drive. And Lucy, thank you. So I guess it's not perfect. Airbnb isn't perfect, and Lucy had a bad experience there, and she wishes there was a 24-hour hotline to report a problem. What about the problem and reporting it, Brad?
I Airbnb is not perfect, but I'm pretty sure they do have a hotline. As Lucy was talking, I just quickly Googled it, and they do see. Well, actually, that's not it. I'll have to look at that, but I thought they do have a hotline, and they've tried to be more responsive to their customers. Because that's the challenge, you know. When they don't own any assets, they cannot control what their hosts do or the quality of the experience. All they can do is let you rate it poorly if you have a bad experience, and so it's pretty important that they go and furnish customers like Lucy with an option when things go wrong. I'm surprised that in this case they didn't. And they're only as good as their customers' experience. And so in that respect, they'll have to do a little bit better.
So I'm sorry. So what if Lucy, thought she had a reservation at a place through Airbnb, and then that person said, nope, sorry, I gave it to somebody else, and, you're kind of stranded. Airbnb will just give a bad review to that particular...
No. Lucy has an opportunity to go and review that person. If she had a reservation and they broke it, then she'll be able to go and leave a one-star review and say, this is an unreliable host. Mm-hmm. And then the next time, someone's going to think twice about using them.
Yeah.
But that doesn't help her, on that night.
Right.
She's got to drive back home. And so, what Airbnb should do, if they had a phone number, that was easily accessible to customers like Lucy, is go and find her an alternative accommodation. Or, there's also a feature on Airbnb called Instant Book. And, maybe nothing was available. But in such cases, it should be easy to go to the app and say, okay, I need something in an hour, and go and find something. That's how it should work. And maybe in this case, it just failed.
We are talking with Brad Stone, author of The Upstarts, How Uber, Airbnb, and the Killer Companies of the New Silicon Valley Are Changing the World. And we are talking about how these companies are changing our world, and wondering if they are changing yours or your communities. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. When we come back, we'll take more of your calls, but we'll also talk about the future for these companies. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about Uber and Airbnb and how they are growing and how they are changing our day-to-day lives when we travel or need some transportation or some lodging. And we welcome your questions for our guest, and we welcome your experiences at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Brad Stone, senior executive editor of global technology at Bloomberg News and the author of The Upstarts. Our next caller is Christine in Eau Claire. Hi, Christine.
Good morning. I'm concerned about the employee aspect or the independent contractor aspect. I talked to a young woman in June from Seattle who quit her managerial job because she could make just as much driving Uber as she could as a management of a retail store. But I'm wondering, does she pay her taxes, you know, her Medicare taxes, her Social Security taxes? Is that all on the independent contractor or slash employee? How does that work with these companies?
Do you know, Brad?
Yeah, well, they're contractors. They're freelancers in respect, at least in the case of Uber drivers and Lyft drivers. And so they have a responsibility to pay their taxes at the end of the year and probably, you know, find an independent source of health care. Many of them were on, the Affordable Health Care Act, and we'll see what that future is. And that goes right to the heart of people's anxieties around the instability of this kind of work. You know, is it a full-time job? I mean, there, lots of drivers extol the flexibility of it, but at the same time, if you're counting on it for your livelihood, it's not offering a lot of protections around your future or your retirement or your health care. And so it's a great question. Uber and Lyft have pretty religiously avoided trying to make these drivers employees, because they don't want the obligation of paying their health care or their retirement. And they also want these drivers to be free to go and set their own schedules and to come out and work in times of high demand. But it's a good question, and that's kind of where our economy is going, right? I mean, there's lots of sectors where it does feel like, you know, retailers or where logistics providers, you know, have kind of cut back in lots of little ways on full-time work and all the protections that it affords and tried to move employees onto part-time or flexible work. And that's a broader conversation I think we have to have in our economy.
Rich in Stevens Point is with us now. Hi, Rich.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead, Rich.
Okay. I was a high school teacher, and the first year I taught, our high school played a game and scoring up 60-0. Now, I am a small businessman. I have apartments, and I also have seasonal rentals. And I just kind of started making a list at a tax hearing. I had 30 things on the list of things that I had to comply with or taxes I paid with. Didn't take me long to expand that list to 60 things that I have to comply with or taxes that I pay or forms that I fill out before I start renting anything. So I guess it's kind of nice to say we have disruptors and people can be a little cocky, but really Airbnb, compared to what I do, the score is 60-0 because people can just rent anything without doing any of the.
Interesting, Rich. What is an example of something you have to do who owns rental properties that Airbnb does not have to do?
Well, I have, I have part-time employees, a lot of times college students. And I've had those for almost 50 years. I file workman's comp. I file, I do pay my self-employment tax. I pay income tax, real estate tax. I do all of the forms for employees. I do all of the forms for licensing the properties. I comply with all the state, national requirements. There's fair housing. There's comfort animals. And it just continues to add up. Now, would you like me to go through?
No, I just wanted an example rather than a long list of 60 things that you have to comply with that Airbnb does not. So what about that, Brad?
Yeah, no, I kind of feel his pain. It might have started as a Wild West. There's a little bit more, that an Airbnb host now does have to do in a city like Green Bay or Madison, where you have to go and get a permit, and there's a requirement to have like a carbon monoxide monitor, but it's different, and like one of the reasons Airbnb has been successful is that it's removed kind of friction from the process. Maybe their goals though are a little bit different. If Rich has some rental, longer term rental properties, and an Airbnb is oriented around a shorter stay, maybe there should be kind of a different set of regulations. But
yeah, Rich, what about that? Your long term rentals, not just for an overnight, right?
It's not. It's really. I also should have seasonal rentals. All right, and it's the same thing. And I'll tell you, I talked to some people in that area. and they had tracked down Airbnb rentals. They talked to the Wisconsin Department of Revenue. They would not even take the list, and the health department would not even take their list of people who were renting on Airbnb. And we have to have our water test. We have to have the property.
Yeah, so I'm sorry, Rich, are you saying that the state or local governments are not cracking down on violators?
I mean, I'm telling the State Department of Revenue and the State Health Department would not even take the list of the people that were renting on Airbnb and weren't paying the taxes.
All right.
I think that there is, Rich is sounding a good note of caution here for state and city regulators. We have to be careful that we're not creating an environment where we're incentivizing people, maybe landlords, to not rent out your home for a year, 2 years to a tenant, but just to list it on Airbnb. And you might make as much money by just opening up to tourists, and then you start to create an environment where there's less. There's less space available for people that want to live in your city. So I think it's something that regulators have to take into account. Create a balanced playing field, or you're going to start pushing property owners to go and just rent to out-of-towners. And we don't want that for our cities. That makes them less livable and changes the character of our neighborhood.
Jim in Belmont is with us. Hi, Jim.
Hey, good morning. So the point I wanted to make is I got three little kids, and we've done some traveling. We stay in Airbnb, and that's the first place I go to look. And the reason for it is if I go and I book a hotel, there's no place to do any cooking. So when we go out, we got little kids, it's hard for us to always take them to a restaurant. 15 minutes in, one of them wants to start running around a little bit. So if we have our own place, an Airbnb that has a stove or some cooking equipment, we can go out and do what we want to do during the day, and then we can come back at night. And we can do our cooking and have our meal, or the same with breakfast. We also find it saves us a little bit of money that way, too.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Jim. Just because of time, I'm going to go right to Jeff in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Yeah, we have used it all over the world, and we continue to, just as your previous caller said, the convenience of them with kitchen and all. But there are three things that we have learned from about Airbnb for users. That
very quickly, Jeff.
Yeah, okay. Never take a place with less than four or five-star ratings. Never take a place where someone reviewed it and said they dropped us at the last moment. And always review the landlord, and they will review you. It's like a community, and the more we know about the renter, the better. That's it.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing those tips. Because we have just a minute or so to go, Brad, what's next for Uber and Airbnb?
I'll give you two quick things. For Uber, not only getting out of their PR storm, but figuring out the role that they can play in a world of driverless cars. It sounds like science fiction, but I've been in a driverless truck and a driverless car, and the technology is coming. And so they have to figure out, do they lead that, or does a Google or a GM or a Tesla lead it? For Airbnb, I think they've capped their primary market of people making their homes available. Growth, at some point will slow down. And they have to figure out what else they can do. And they're trying to broker experiences. Like, can you get someone like the previous caller and set them up with a local cook or help them visit a tourist attraction or give them a tour? And so they want to branch out into other experiences, maybe even doing their plane fares. And that would turn Airbnb not just into an accommodations company, but a travel company. And that's a big opportunity.
Well, this has been fun. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy.
Brad Stone is author of The Upstarts, How Uber, Airbnb, and the Killer Companies of the New Silicon Valley Are Changing the World. Thanks to Brianne Schossel for producing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to The Ideas Network.